My Word.
A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. And here to introduce the teams is Michael O'Donnell.
Thank you very much, and welcome to another bout of competitive philology between Dilys Powell and Frank Muir. And Antonia Fraser and Dennis Norden. And we start, as always, with a dip into the dictionary to find what meaning lies therein. Frank, what's the meaning of sesquipedalian? S-E-S-Q-U-I-P-E-D-A-L-I-A-N.
There's an organ pipe called a sesquialtra. Is that cogent?
Cogent, but not pertinent, I don't think.
it's also what... I don't think this is the answer, but it's also what Samuel Johnson is often totally wrongly accused of, which is using long words, overlong words.
Boswell, in fact. Boswell, the example given in the shorter Oxford Dictionary is actually from Boswell and says, finding one of his sesquipedalian words hang fire. And they don't say what he did, but that's the example. But you got it right. We'll give you two marks because it's polysyllabic words and give people who are giving to using long words. Antonia. Oh, this is too easy for you. What is a catechumen?
Oh, well, I was once a catechumen, I think, myself.
I thought you might have been.
Yes. It's when you're being catechized with a view to being a convert. And it's fine being a catechumen nowadays and a convert. But I think catechumens who found themselves, if I can get this right, in the catacombs or catacombs of Rome, were liable to be grabbed and thrown to the Catalans or flogged with the cat o' nine tails. This is getting too far. But anyway, there are people who are instructed with the catechism, aren't they?
Exactly. A religious convert under instruction, two marks to Antonia. Dilys, what's the meaning of fanfaronade or fanfaronade?
How do you spell it?
F-A-N-F-A-R-O-N-A-D-E.
Oh, it's a kind of exaggerated speech, I think. Isn't it? Sort of show-off speech.
That'll do. Two marks.
That'll do.
Boastful or arrogant bluster, says the dictionary. It's also a flourish of trumpets. Dennis, what's the meaning of cinerary? C-I-N-E-R-A-R-Y. Cinerary.
That's a new one on me. What it looks like is if literary is means of or pertaining to literature, then cinerary should be of or pertaining to the cinema. So Dilys would be a cinerary luminary. Or would that be right? No, I can say
it would be wrong, but I think it gets two marks because it's much more interesting than the real meaning. You can get a bonus mark if you can tell us what the real meaning is.
I know.
Ashes? Something to do with ashes?
Is it incinerate? Yes. That's a good idea, yes. Ashes. Would it be... it's obviously not a cricketing term. It's the other ashes, is it? Yeah.
Yes. Is it medical?
No, it isn't. No. That which pertains to ashes, it says in the dictionary, particularly of a cremated body.
I'll be faithful to you, Sinuary, in my version.
Now we move on. Well, before we go on to round two, here, Frank and Dennis, are the quotations you were given for the last round. And Frank's is, onward Christian soldiers. And Dennis's is, red sails in the sunset, which always reminds me of Suzette Tarry.
Oh, yes.
Meanwhile, a round entitled Something in Common. What do the following words have in common? Frank, a mob, a curio, spats and pants.
From a great many years' experience on this programme, is there anything to do with sport?
No.
Oh. some sort of obscure trade?
No.
Some obscure profession?
No.
Like
two done. You've got 18 more questions.
Can you eat?
It's to do with, if you don't look so much at the quality, but more at the width, it might
We don't need quality, we need mercy here. Curio is curiosity.
Yes.
Spats is spatterdashes, isn't it?
Yes.
And pence is what? Pantaloons?
Yes.
Pantoof.
Pantaloons. So, all are...
All are slang.
No.
Well, what?
They're all...
All part of a grand mystery.
Called life. They're all curtailed words. Curiosity... Spatterdashes, which if I'd worn spats, I'd have called them spatterdashes, and pantaloons, and mob apparently is curtailed mobile vulgus, or a mobile vulgus.
Mm. So ladies wore mobile vulgus hats, did they?
Pants.
Caps.
And curious spats and mobile pantaloons. Anyway, sorry, that's...
In a way, I enjoyed it. Question?
Antonia, what do the following words have in common? A bulletin, a coupon, debris and sabotage. I think Frank got it from that. I hear that sort of Frank.
I think they're all French words.
Well, all lifted from the French language.
Yes.
Two marks for Antonia.
It's from debris, cheesy. And so on.
As opposed to de Camembert, you mean?
Yeah.
Dillis, your collection sounds a bit like a firm of solicitors. Timothy, Fescue and Fogg.
Oh.
It could actually be a ventriloquist, couldn't it?
Timothy
Fescue and Fogg.
Fescue.
Yeah, it's, anyway, it's three words. Timothy. F-E-S-C-U-E is Fescue and Fogg.
Speaking as a horticulturist of note.
Yes. The middle word, Fescue... A sheep's fescue, which is a kind of grass, as I remember when I was an innocent child gathering, collecting wild flowers. So I've never known that fog or whatever was a grass or Timothy, but anyhow, they're all grass.
Well, that'll get you 2 marks. Well done. Dennis, a bull, an archer, twins and a goat. A bull, an archer, twins, and a goat.
Give him a bit. It obviously isn't an everyday story of country folk. Is it either Latin or... Is it Taurus, Sagittarius, yes? Gemini? I'm trying to think. Oh, Capricorn, isn't it? It's that load of bilge, is it?
Yeah. I'm glad you call it a load of bilge. I endorse the sentiment and give you 2 marks for...
Nice
they're all signs of the zodiac. Yeah.
My stars yesterday in a large paper with a huge circulation, Aquarius, said somebody will say something extraordinary to you. I can't read that in the stars.
I love it. I think it gives great happiness, particularly to me. My birthday's just coming up. Please take note, everybody. And I always read the coming year. It always says the same. The coming year will be mixed good and bad, but how pleased you will have been that it has passed.
Let's move on to a round... Our word setter, Peter Moore, calls a round of unique utterances. What spoken sentence of historical significance contained the following word, but not necessarily in the order I'm going to quote them? And by whom was it uttered? And Frank, your sentence contains the words fool, fool, people, people, people. You have to be very careful with this one.
Yeah, I imagine that it's the Abraham Lincoln speech.
Yes. That's one mark. Now, what
you can
the
fool some of the people say? Some of the time, and you can fool people all of the people all of the time, but you can't fool the people you fooled half of the time, all of the time, because the people you fooled...
Yes, well...
One always thinks that everything Lincoln said, he said in the Gettysburg Address. It didn't, did it?
No, that's, I don't know where he said that. He certainly, because I read the Gettysburg Address and the Lincoln Memorial.
I don't think that's original. He certainly made it popular, but I don't think it's original. And I think it's only attributed anyway, but it's good. It's a good thing to say.
Where do you think it came from? You sound as though you know.
No.
Antonia, your historical utterance contains the words leap, step, man, mankind.
It's Neil Armstrong, isn't it?
Yes. That's one mark.
Leaping onto the moon, which he said something like, it's one small step for Neil Armstrong and one great leap for mankind.
Well, we'll give you a mark for it. There is a certain amount of confusion as to what he said. Everybody,
but I was on the moon at the time, and I had to quit.
We were all on the moon at the time, weren't we? Precariously. He's delivered it like a boy delivering a line that he hadn't quite, or he'd overlearned for the school play.
Yeah.
So what he'd actually said, crackle, crackle, was one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, which is ungrammatical or meaningless. But if that's what he was reported as saying, and which I think he did say, but he claims, he said, one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. It was one of the present president's speechwriters, I suspect, worked it out for him before he left. Anyway, we'll give you two marks, Antonio. Dillis, many, much, few, never.
Many, much. What's the third one?
Many, much, few. Few is this dominant one in people's memory.
P-H-E-W.
Oh, that's Churchill.
Yes, indeed.
That's Churchill saying, never have so many owed so much to so few.
You left out a little bit, but we'll give you the mark. It's never in the field of human conflict with so much owed by so many to so few.
So it is after the Battle of Britain.
Yes, indeed. Two marks to Duluth. And among the few were Dennis and Frank, weren't you? Were you both in the RAF?
Yes, but under different circumstances.
I don't think he was referring to us, was he?
I fondly thought that he was.
Yeah.
Dennis, your utterance, historic utterance, is I. I'll give you a clue. It's not Carmen Miranda.
What do you mean? It's a personal pronoun.
Personal pronouns.
Well, that would be the present Prime Minister in any speech, I would
imagine.
Well, I can only think of songs. I love them. You've got to do something about your handwriting.
Yes, I have.
How you wrote those?
You write?
Oh, Steve. J. Caesar.
Yeah, it should be BBB, really.
Yes, that's right, yes. I came, I saw, I conquered. Is it? Yeah?
Yes.
Mainly
BBB. Yeah. Two marks for Dennis. I came, I saw, I conquered. Caesar J. Well done. Two marks. What it reminds me of was what I always think was one of the archetypal lines, and take it from here. I always remember your Roman soldiers numbering. Would you like to remind us of how they numbered?
Roman soldiers, from the left, number.
I, V.
And now we come to the last round and Frank's and Dennis's quotations. And Frank's quotation is, onward, Christian soldiers.
I sang that. Onward, Christian. I sang it just after Mr. Churchill made that speech about never in the field of human conflict. And it was 1942, Christmas Day, in a Nissen hut at Kaldadarnes RAF station in Iceland. And absolutely true. See, it was by mid-December, we in the hut, there were six of us and a corporal, I decided that things were going to go very badly because the whole air station the aerodrome hadn't been finished, and we had no beds to lie on. It was cold enough to freeze the motto off a Christmas card. The wind came up through the floorboards like razor blades, and we had to do something about it. Now,
Jos Nankerville, who was the brains of the hut, he said we've got to do something about this. He was somebody. We had an officer say that he was head boy at Lancing. And we thought, as a medical student, we used to go to him with our tummy. But it wasn't. It was a public school. But he was very, very brainy. Jos Nankerville. And he said, leave this to me. I'll give it a bit of thought. And he said, the first thing to do in these circumstances is to corrupt authority. And so that was Corporal Wood. Corporal Wood slept in a little hut at the end, a little bit off our hut. And Corporal Wood was we called Oaky, and he was dreadful. He was non-okay in any way, nasty little man. And Nankerville said, we've got to get him in our grip. So I was a photographer, and they had no aerial cameras, so time hung heavy. And he persuaded Saul, who was one of our number. His name wasn't Saul. I don't know what it was. He called him Saul because he had a kind of New Testament face. And he spent all the evenings cleaning his feet. He used to push a finger between his toes. They weren't dirty because he did it every night. And he worked in the cookhouse and used to pair his toes. He used to pair his toenails with the unit carving knife. But he was frightfully good at negotiating. And so, but our boss, Jos, our brain, sent Saul to the local farm, the local sheep farm, and said that I would take photographs of the farmhouse and everybody in it in return for a churn of milk. And he took the milk on a lorry supplied by Big John, who was in the transport department. And he was called Big John, enormous. He used to work on a farm. And it was so cold there that the hydraulic jacks in the transport section used to freeze up. So John used to hold the lorries up while they changed the wheels. And Big John drove this churn and Saul down to Reykjavik, the capital. And under instructions, Saul bargained this for a lilo, which is a rubberized canvas airbed. And we then presented that to the corporal and said, Corp, we can't see you sleeping so badly. Will you have this on semi-permanent loan? And he said, yes, lads. And Jos said, may we now improve our own sleeping facilities? And the corporal knew what he meant and said, oh, okay, but don't let me catch you. So the whole unit sprung into action. Big John at the transport got 24 empty petrol cans, and they were going to be the legs of our beds. Then we needed doors to sleep on. And the Pioneer Corps were building new Nissen huts. So Greasy George, or George the Grease, who used to have that white cream they used to sell in those days combed into his hair. And when he combed his hair, he used to come out grey and shiny. George the Grease was kind of one of nature's burglars. He could get into anything. And he used to get into the huts at night, and he'd unscrew one door, one new door, and Big John would tuck it under his arm, and we'd go back and put it on one of the four petrol tins. And in six nights, for some reason or other, the pioneers didn't miss the doors, which is most extraordinary. So we had a door each on four petrol tins. Now, all it needed was a little bit more bargaining and a few more photographs of the farmer to get some straw so that we could have sort of palliassy tops. Now, we were okay. We were wonderful temperature, except that it was stone cold. There was no fuel because the camp wasn't finished. There was nothing to burn in the stove. So we sprung into action again, and Little Ern helped here, because Little Ern, who was a sixth member, was very popular. He did card tricks, and he went over during the daytime to where the pioneers were building these huts and did card tricks. And they all grouped round and left the huts. And Big John ripped up the floorboards. And I, being the tallest, they were about 5 foot long, and I, being the tallest, could slip a floorboard down the outside of one leg and under the battle dress jacket, under the armpit, and another on the other side, and with rather a stiff lick, not unlike Frankenstein's monster, could get back to our hut undetected. And in 8 days, we had our floorboards stuffed
with burnable wood, and we were, and came Christmas, there we were, lying back on our beds, soft on the straw palliasses, up from the floor, away from the draughts, with this floorboard fire in the stove, turning the iron of the stove into cherry red. And I, sipping our special Christmas issue beer, said, messmates, hut colleagues, may I raise my glass to you and toast you? In a hymn, in an old hymn with, perhaps I may give, new words. Gentlemen, I sing to you, Urn, wood, grease, John, saw, joss.
That one coming.
I didn't think it was coming. I saw it departing.
I like these moving instalments from your war memoirs. Dennis, let's see how you make out with Red Sails in the Sunset.
Well, we also go back on this one, but this time to a period just after I left school, when we were living in a South Coast seaside town, and I was spending all my spare moments collecting material for a novel. You know, paper, pencil, typewriter, ribbon, you know, that sort of thing. But because I needed something to tide me over till I picked up the £30,000 that goes with the Nobel Prize for Literature, I'd taken a job as a cub reporter on the town's weekly newspaper. And when I say cub reporter, I mean that literally, because all my editor ever let me report were meetings of the local cubs. Scouts, brownies, you know, school sports days, that sort of thing. And the reason he kept me away from reporting events of more significant news value was because I suffered from what has to be a handicap to any working journalist. I couldn't read my own handwriting. Now, that unfortunate disability was first spotted when they printed a story of mine describing a visiting star of stage and screen, and I wrote that she was wearing a decorative banana round her neck, that being the nearest I could get to deciphering the word bandana. Or to give an even more serious example, one where we subsequently had to print a front page apology, there was the occasion I reported that a local councillor was objecting to the unsightly discolorations on the face of the town clerk. Well, that, of course, was my misreading of what I'd written down for town clock. So that's why my skills as a reporter were now confined to tasks like reviewing the local kindergarten's end-of-term concert. You know the sort of thing. Unfortunately, the scripture class was missing one Israelite due to chicken pox. So for this performance only, the part of Pharaoh was taken by Mrs. Henley. Now, agree that that's hardly the kind of hard-hitting journalism that gets them clamoring to book you for what the papers say, but it was while I was at that concert, waiting backstage to get the full name of the little girl who played the burning bush, it was then I noticed something I jotted down in my reporter's notebook the previous afternoon. See, my editor had sent me along to the local yacht club, one of my least favourite places in the town, if only because instead of giving their loose signs that said ladies and gentlemen, they'd labelled them inboard and outboard, thus causing non-boating types like me hours of uncertainty and discomfort. But I'd been ordered there to interview the winners of the under-12s dinghy race, a couple of 10-year-old twin brothers, and now, looking again what they told me when I asked for some information about their family, because on that kind of paper the game is to get in as many local names as possible. But I suddenly noticed something that seemed to have the makings of a real story. Because according to my notes, one of the things they'd mentioned about their father was that he was an active communist. Now, well, I thought there can't be many militant Marxists who've enrolled their kids in a hotbed of blue blazered bourgeoisie like the yacht club. So, remembering H.L. Mencken's definition of news as anything that makes your old aunt say, good gracious. I there and then dashed off 300 words of well-turned irony, added what I thought was a rather nifty headline, and dropped it into the paper. Well, as you probably guessed, I'd made another handwriting cock-up. The lads at the yacht club hadn't said their dad was an active communist. Well, they'd actually said, as was established during the subsequent libel action he brought against the paper, what they'd actually said was that he was acting Commodore. But just to say, there are still some old Fleet Street hands who envy that phrase I cooked up as a headline for my story about a communist whose twin boys had joined the yachting fraternity. Red's sons in the sail set.
Thank you, Dennis. I see from the score sheet that the laurel leaves today go to Antonia and Dennis. Oh. Gillis and Frank will have to make do with a small sachet of potpourri until they come fighting back, I'm sure, in our next programme. And until then, goodbye.
In My World, Michael O'Donnell was in the chair. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the programme was produced for the BBC by Tony Shrine and Pete Atkin. You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.